Good evening. Let's turn that back on. Good evening, everybody. It's exciting to have so many of us here together tonight to have an opportunity to learn a little bit. So let me take a moment to introduce myself. It's many very familiar faces and some not so familiar. So let's have an opportunity to do that as well. Introduce myself, introduce the topic a little bit, and also talk about talking about the topic. And then we'll dive right in. My name is Rabbi Michael Dolgen. I'm still new at the synagogue. This is only my 26th year here. Well, Rabbi Perlson was here 41 from the time he founded the synagogue until when he retired. Thank you. I get a day older every day like everybody else, thank God. But it's great to be here together with you. When I first came to Temple Sinai in 1992, I could tell how much people at the synagogue love Israel because as one of the new rabbis, the new junior rabbi, people would say to me, et cetera, hello, how are you? Are you married? What's your wife's name? Et cetera. And, oh, have you been to Israel? And I would say, yes. And they would say, oh, how many times? And I said, once. And they went, oh, like such a shanda, right? To speak good Israeli Hebrew, not at all, right? I would say only once, and they would say, "Oh, for how long?" And I say, "Oh, a year," because the first time I was ever in Israel, I lived there for a year. And so it's interesting that the experience that most people have first of Israel, which is as a tourist, if they're not lucky enough to be born there, the experience that people first have, I've actually never had. Because the first time I was there, while we did some touristy things during the course of the year as part of the program, had the privilege of living there for a year, and actually most of the credit to what made that year so important to me actually goes to my wife, Joan, because while I was there studying at the Hebrew Union College in my first year of rabbinical school with 36 other people from North America, my wife Joan was the only spouse of a member of the program who had a real Israeli job. Everyone else who had a spouse, either they didn't have a job or they had a job in an English language kind of a bubble. But Joan had a real everyday job working at a school in Jerusalem for children with autism. And so between that and family connections there, we really did have, it doesn't mean that I know what it's like to live long-term in Israel, wouldn't claim to know, but we really did have a different kind of an experience and to meet a different kind of Israel. So I have a great love and appreciation for both what Israel has been, what Israel is, and what I hope Israel will yet become. And I'm excited that we have the opportunity to come together for these three Tuesday nights to look back again, because I don't think it gets done enough in the world today, to look back at some of the founding ideological giants of earlier Zionism, to not only to learn about them in a historical manner, but also because, as if I need to tell this group of people, I think you know from your own life experience that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And so it's astonishing to see how many of the issues, how many of the statements, how many of the ideas about what Israel could be, what Zionism is all about, are still in play. And so I'm excited, and my plan for these three nights is really for us together if you will. We're not going to hear recordings, but to listen to by sharing them in written form and reflect upon the statements of some of these Zionists in their own words, or at least in translation. I can't read Herzl in German. So I know Shavel is disappointed here that I can't read it in the original German, but in fact I can't. So we're reading them in translation, but nevertheless these are translations of the words, the ideas that they came about. The only night where we're talking about only one person is tonight. Shocking, and that's Theodor Herzl. Because of course if there is one person whose ideas and whose statements need to be considered, both for their formative impact in the past and to see them as a kind of a lens on today and on ourselves as Jews in the larger world and on what 100 years after the Balfour Declaration that Israel has become, then I can't think of any place else to start. And we could do all three nights on Herzl, but that's not the plan. They're really snippets, but an opportunity for us to consider where Zionism has come from, the different ideas of what Israel and Zionism could be, because it was a really varied way of thinking in the early part of the creation of these ideas. That now, thank God, have become this wonderful, messy, fantastic, challenging, blessed reality that is Israel. And we'll talk about those things. So I did promise that in addition to talking about them, because we're Jews, first we're going to talk about talking about them. Let me explain what I mean. All I mean is, you know the old joke, right, which is no longer correct, two Jews, three opinions. I think when it comes to Israel, the number goes up to four or five. No idea in the Jewish world in general, and in our times in particular, arouses more genuine and intense feeling than issues around the state of Israel and around Zionism and around where we've come from and where we ought to be going. So I do want to first acknowledge not only the strength of those feelings, but to encourage us, because it's not just going to be you sitting here listening to me for time after time, when we participate, to keep in mind that, of course, we're going to disagree. It would be concerning if we didn't. And that it's our practice in the world, and it's a Jewish practice, even though some seem to have forgotten, to disagree in a respectful way. And listen as best we can to both those who might agree with us and those who don't agree with us. So just because of the strong feelings that these topics arise, I just wanted to make sure to say that out loud before we jump right into the topic that we're discussing. So tell me, because like I said, you don't need to just come and listen to me for time after time, hour after hour. We're not going to be here that many hours tonight anyway. But when you think of the name, when you hear the name Theodor Herzl, what do you think of? What is the idea, the image, the sense of him that shows up in your mind? Because many of you know quite a bit about him already. I'll make sure we all do by the time we're done. But what time, you know, we always supply teenagers for people to look at to go, oh, young Jews in a synagogue, what a great day. Anyway, when you hear Theodor Herzl, what do you think of? Yes?
The Dreyfus Affair.
Okay, so the Dreyfus Affair, to draw that out, right? Herzl, during his his whole life, unfortunately, was quite brief. And during his early professional life, was a journalist, and he was assigned by the paper for which he worked in Vienna to be their Paris correspondent. And so he was in Paris during the Dreyfus trial, right, when a Jewish senior officer, Dreyfus, was falsely accused and convicted and then convicted again of treason on charges that were clearly and not too long after were admittedly falsely created because of his Jewishness. Right? That this, in for a man coming from Vienna, a seat of enlightened Western culture, and serving in Paris, another seat of enlightened Western culture, this had a massive impact on Theodor Herzl, to see that modern Western rational enlightened thought was not the end of anti-Semitism, and in fact was not a tonic for anti-Semitism. And we will see in his own writings his reflection on, quote-unquote, the Jewish question, because that was a big part of what did and didn't motivate Herzl to choose the direction that he did. So the Dreyfus trial, that's a great place to start and tells us something about who Herzl was and a moment in his life. Tell me something else. It doesn't have to be so detailed. It can be general or specific, whatever seems right. What else do you think of when you hear Theodor Herzl?
Well, I was raised in a house where Theodor Herzl was the hero. And wherever there was a chance to have a picture of him on the wall, he was there. My parents were Zionists, and they wanted me to understand the importance of who Theodor Herzl was. And I still remember that in my younger days. And the groups that formed around the idea of my parents and their friends and what they did to further the idea of Zionism in Toronto and education. That was their
goal. Okay, so Sheila mentioning that in her house, in case everybody couldn't hear, that Herzl was, there was a picture of him on the wall. I mean, he was, and eventually, Herzl was, in that sense, he was not necessarily a more significant figure in the day-to-day workings of Zionism than others, but he was the visionary. He was the organizer. He was the person that, while there were lots of people involved in Zionism, that he is the face of Zionism because it was his response, his vision, and his particular vision that we're going to look at more closely tonight that had so much to do with bringing Jews together around the idea of Zionism. So that's great. Thank you. Mildred had her hand up, and then Carla. Oh. Okay, so clearly it wasn't only in Sheila's house that Theodor Herzl... How many people here, I'm curious, grew up in a home or knew someone in whose home was a picture of Theodor Herzl on the wall? Not a big group, but that's okay. Not mine either. Carla, what did you want to say? Yes. He convened the... Pardon? Oh, of course. Yes, that's what I was going to do, but thank you very much. Absolutely. The question was, didn't he convene the Zionist congresses that began in Basel, Switzerland? And he did. He wasn't alone, because no one person can do such a thing, but he was the central organizing figure in the Zionist congresses. And in fact, we're going to look at two things tonight in specific words of Theodor Herzl. That is, first, we're going to look at the preface of his pamphlet, he called it, his book, The Jewish State, which was published in 1896. And then we're going to look at excerpts that I've chosen for you from his speeches at the first four Zionist congresses, three of them in Basel, Switzerland, and one of them in London, England. And I think it's very important to acknowledge that while Herzl is known as a visionary, and unquestionably was, It's the organization power that he and his colleagues created. It's thinking in practical terms, not merely in visionary terms, that made Herzl so important and that resulted in the amazing reality in which we now live. That he could not have imagined. For had there not been the organizational structure that he begins to talk about early on around the movement called Zionism, if we weren't a homeland or a state in waiting, when the historical moment came, we would not have been able to move forward and to see the realization of the first major stage of Zionism, that being the announcement of and the creation of the State of Israel, which was not the end of Zionism, but the end of of the pre-state stage of it. Carmela?
And then wasn't he prepared to accept Uganda?
Okay, the question is, wasn't he prepared to accept Uganda? And interestingly enough, while the Ugandan option came along later, the two options that he talks about in his early speeches at the Zionist Congress were Israel and Argentina. Right? How many people know about the De Hirsch colonies for Jews here in Canada? Baron De Hirsch, in Europe, looking to improve the lot of Jews, bought land outside of Europe to create farming communities, because that was the way Jews could get through immigration, so that Jews could have places in North and South America, and all along the southern part of Saskatchewan. Do you have family? Are you from that area? Okay. In Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
I'll repeat. It's okay. Right, so it's now a historic site that places like Hirsch or De Hirsch, Saskatchewan, and Estevan, Saskatchewan, and a number of these other small farming villages were Jewish towns that were created in Canada by Baron De Hirsch. But in fact, there were a much larger number of them in Argentina and earlier on. So there was already a collection of Jewish settlement activity in Argentina at the same time that there was the first Aliyah, the earliest settlement activity in the modern era of Jews in the land of Israel coming from outside. So what we want to get at tonight with his help is trying to figure out what was driving this reality, right? So I want to take a moment, sort of put off some comments for the moment, and we'll have more opportunity to talk together later on, but talk just a moment about the particular window in history that we're talking about. Right, we're talking about the late 1890s of the time of his most actions and his response to the Dreyfus trial, as mentioned. Right, Theodor Herzl was there a lot, and it's funny because he's such a figure. People have reconstructed his life in different ways. So I don't want to get lost in his biography. I want to stick to the bare bones that everybody seems to agree with. And that is, first of all, that he was born in Budapest, but he really lived in Vienna, his family having relocated to Vienna. And while there are different descriptions of their close or distant connection to their Jewish identity and the Jewish community, Herzl certainly didn't grow up as a traditional religious Jew. In that sense, but certainly he identified as a Jewish person. But his activities, and it comes through even in his Zionist writings, His activities were as a Western enlightened person. Now, when I say enlightened, I don't mean that he was bright or educated. What I'm actually talking about is a particular philosophical movement that really created what I would call the modern way of thinking. Enlightenment thinking, or the Haskalah in Hebrew, is really the advent in the modern world of scientific, critical thinking, using a scientific and a critical methodology, not only in certain areas in life, but applying it to all areas of our life. Believing that all received knowledge, information, or those presented as revelation, religion, can be questioned. And believing that the state of the world around us is ours to improve and affect. That the state of the world is not to be taken in general as it is today as an expression of some divine will, or for those who are not religious, as the way things have always been and the way they always should be, but rather through logic and rational inquiry, through scientific advancement and philosophical speculation, that we have the ability to understand our world, and that everything around us should be open to question. This idea now doesn't really sound like a radical idea anymore because it's become so much a part of the world in which we live. But modern times are a reaction in many ways to these basic ideas. And let's talk, I want to talk in a second about how it is, what does that say, since we are Jews, how did this live itself out in the life of the Jewish people leading up to Herzl? Jeff, do you want to say something before I do that?
Mm-hmm. You know, emancipation, Enlightenment period, there is the aspect of the scientific emergence, especially with European Jews in that period, and challenging, questioning how things were, that religion and all that is not the end all. The other thing that did emerge, though, from the French Revolution to the 19th century was the notion of rights.
Well, that's the next example I was going to give. What Jeff is saying is, in addition to this questioning of everything, there's the idea, really, of rights, of citizenship, and in regard to the Jews, of what's called emancipation. Jews historically, since the end of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel a couple thousand years ago, lived as a tolerated, separate population. That Jews were not regarded as citizens of any particular location, but rather we lived at the whim of the local ruler because we were regarded as different. The idea that the Jewish identity as a national identity made us separate and separable from everyone else. So when the Jews were expelled from England in 1290 and from France in 1394 and from Spain in 1492 and from Portugal in 1497, these were not surprising events because we're not regarded as having any innate right to live in any particular place. And that was not only true of Jews, right? That was true in that time of any foreign group, any group that were regarded as non-native who were living in some national area. The long time in which the Jewish people lived in Germanic areas is less about the Jews being more popular or more tolerated in that area than that it took much longer historically for Germany to become a unified country. So when Jews were no longer welcome in one small part of Germany, they just moved next door to a slightly different part where they were welcome. But in France with Napoleon in the first decade of the 1800s, this is something I teach the grade six families every year, he called together what he called the Assembly of Notables, the leadership, the modern Sanhedrin, the high court of the Jewish people in his mind, to ask them questions about can Jews function as citizens of a modern country. It's not so much the questions he asked and the answers, but the fact that life had changed so much that these questions could be asked. And so Jews, for the first time, were given entree to be a full part of a larger society, and people who could have rights to live in that place rather than being a tolerated population. Right? So we know that the millennial reality of anti-Semitism, of people hating the Jews, of mistrusting us as the other, and relating to us in that way. And so the fact that as modern times emerged, people questioned old ways, and Western European countries in particular, went through this process of identifying that Jews, in fact, could be citizens and could be part of a larger country, it created questions both from without and from within about Jewish identity. And the 1800s were certainly, the latter half of the 1800s, were a very idealistic time for many, believing that it was possible for rational thinking, Enlightenment thinking, that states extending rights to Jews, that in fact the reality of being a Jew could change, that we could become accepted by the larger societies around us, and that we could be safe and secure without our own country to look after us. And as we were saying earlier, it was really in Herzl's life, it was really his experience at the Dreyfus trial, at the Dreyfus affair, that convinced him that while the form of states and the ideas of states had changed, that in fact the underlying reality in which the Jewish people were living, and as we'll see in his words now in just a minute, the impact of that experience on the Jews was unremedied by modern thinking and emancipation without the opportunity for the Jewish people to have their very own state, to have their very own homeland. And that idea, while he doesn't have all the answers, to him was the key, of course. And that's what becomes the heart of Zionism. Zion, of course, Tzion, being a name for the land of Israel, but in particular for Yerushalayim, for Jerusalem as well. So what we're going to see in his writing, and it's a painful question to reflect on today. Because again, this year, as much as there are lots of different important issues and challenging social issues to be addressed here in Canada, again this past year, the subgroup within Canada against whom the most acts of hate and prejudice were perpetrated in this past year was again the Jews. Right? Even in Canada, which I think we would agree in general that that actually we're very lucky as Jews to live in a place like Canada. And nonetheless, more than a century on from the times that we're looking at, this reality continues unabated, and some of the deeply disturbing trends that we see in U.S. Affairs and that echo very close to home here in Canada as well, make us aware of the challenge of the situation in which our people live, even now in a world with the Jewish state. But we'll get to that in a moment. But what I want to do now is I want to take a moment. I'll just throw a bunch of these on each of the tables. Sure, that would be fine, but I'm not sure that we didn't quite expect such a wonderful turnout, so there should be at least if people can share what you have here, and maybe actually if somebody else who's feeling able can help me out. The next thing we'll look at are the excerpts from his speeches. You don't need those yet, but we'll throw those on the tables now too so that we don't have to lose more time later in looking at those. So there are going to be two collections of papers on your tables, as I said. One of them, the first one, which is a single page, and the first entry of Herzl's diary just came along on the page, but I thought it was something worth seeing or hearing as well. And then just while we could spend so much time on the whole document, the preface, the beginning of his book, The Jewish State. He calls it a pamphlet, published, as I said, in 1896. And then we'll get to the excerpts that I've chosen for you from the speeches that he delivered in the Zionist Congress. So, again, any time if you want a cookie or you want to grab a cup of decaf coffee or whatever, you know, feel free at any point to grab what's there for all of us at the back. But it's I'm fascinated by the first entry in his diary. And again, Herzl was a journalist, and journalists, true journalists, not people who smile at us while they're standing in a hurricane and trying to win an Emmy, but journalists have a real sense of history. You really can't be a journalist if you don't. So I want to take a moment to read, because I think the words are inspiring, the first entry in his diary, but I want to make sure we don't miss something else. All right, so you have it there if you want to read. I'm mostly reading also because some people couldn't make this session. I'm actually recording the session as well, so that some people who are coming the next 2 weeks, they didn't want to miss tonight's session. With the microphone, it's easier for me to read, because I think the words, even though you can read just fine, it's different to hear them aloud. So here's the first entry in his diary, 1895. Says Herzl, "I have been occupied for some time past with a work which is of immeasurable greatness. I cannot tell today whether I shall bring it to a close. It has the appearance of a gigantic dream, but for days and weeks it has filled me, saturated even my subconsciousness. It accompanies me wherever I go, broods above my ordinary daily converse, looks over my shoulder, and at my petty comical journalistic work disturbs me and intoxicates me. What it will lead to, it is impossible to surmise as yet. But my experience tells me that it is something marvelous, even as a dream, and that I should write it down, if not as a memorial for mankind, then for my own delight or meditation in later years, and perhaps for something between both these possibilities, for the enrichment of literature. If the romance does not become a fact, at least the fact can become a romance. Title, The Promised Land." It's... It is a reminder that we write a little differently now than we did then, and in my opinion, something's been lost. But so much of our communication is instantaneous and not necessarily thought through. It is interesting that he is clearly he is entranced, he is captivated, he is fascinated. He is touched by the idea of the Jewish community being gathered in and having a proper home. That it is a profound idea. And we can tell he thinks it's a profound idea. I know this is tricky because he says it is. But there's another clue on the page. Do you know what that is? Look at the date for the item. Okay? So, and again, he's not a religious person. But what he writes as the date for his first, and he's the one who listed it as the first entry in his diary on Shavuot 1895. Why Shavuot? Because Shavuot is the time of revelation. Right? Shavuot is not just a holiday, it's the giving of Torah. That's what it is. It is the essence of the Jewish story, and it says, here is the high point, here's the peak. Here is the revelation of what Judaism is supposed to be. So I really think that it would be absurd to suggest, especially not as a religious person, that there's anything accidental about the timing of his journal entry. I don't think he's being arrogant in saying he's rewriting the Torah. But he is saying that this is a revolutionary moment, a revelatory moment in his mind, in the history of the Jewish people. Because he's starting off on his writing about this idea. And I will say that even today, people have different feelings about how about this kind of strong statement about Zionism. I had a discussion this past year. We were privileged to have in Toronto, thanks to activity of Arts of Canada, of our Reform Zionist organization, and of Temple Har Tzion. We had an Israeli Reform rabbi who was in Toronto, working here for Arts of Canada and Temple Har Tzion for 8 months. Rabbi Benji Gruber, he's a rabbi in the southern Negev, in the Arava. He's a wonderful guy. And I said to him in a conversation that we had, I said to him, I don't know what you think of this. I don't know, you're Jews, so I know you won't tell me. You'll just be shy and not share your opinions. I hope not. I'm being sarcastic. But I said to him, you know, it's an honor to be involved and to have some impact on the work of our movement in Israel and rabbis like himself who serve in Israel, because I said the Jewish future will be decided by what happens in the state of Israel. And it's funny, the North American rabbi says the future is going to be decided by Israel, and the Israeli art rabbi starts to argue with him. Starts to disagree with me, you shouldn't say that what you do here is any less important. And I said, I'm not saying that, but keep in mind, we're nearing the day from a time where Herzl had the idea, in a formal sense, of a Jewish state, though he was not the first Zionist thinker by any stretch. But where he promulgated, I would say, the idea, we're getting close to the point in the next number of years where the majority of the world's Jews will be Israelis. So think about the power of that numerically. We're probably 10 years from that. But that is the evolution of who Jews are and where we live and how we live. And while I committed my life to the Jewish experience in the diaspora, you don't see me making aliyah. I'm very proud to be part of this community and this temple and to have the privilege of doing the work that I do. But that doesn't change the numbers. That in the Jewish future numerically is in the state of Israel, and all of the Jews have a say in our future. I still see the power of Herzl's statements and his ideas reflected in this incredible reality in which we live, where that number of Jews, that's where we find them, right? half of the Jews in the world live in five cities. Right? So if you're there are four people who live in your house, two of them live elsewhere. No, that's not true. It's amazing because we've become a very urban people, which we weren't as much in Herzl's day either. Half of all the Jews in the world. No, Toronto's not one of them. Everybody assumes it is. We're close. Half of the Jews in the world live in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Haifa, New York City, and Los Angeles. You add up the population of those five cities of Jewish people, and you get half the Jews in the whole world. Right? So numbers, while they're not our main focus, our numbers don't define what we ought to do, but they are significant. And here, Herzl talks about the significant and the beauty of the Zionist idea. And notice the title is The Promised Land. And still, he's talking in the language of romance. And because, as you'll see, even in the opening Zionist Congress, the language was not always about a Jewish state. It was about a Jewish homeland. That the importance was having a place where we would be safely protected in a permanent way, and where we would have rights to control our own destiny. And that was the main idea that we find here, even again in a pamphlet called The Jewish State. So it's not that he was uncommitted to the idea, but in fact that romantically he was talking about a larger concept that he clearly didn't know exactly how it was going to make its way. So I want to make sure we get to at least a number of the discussions from his speeches. So I want to take the time to read parts of, not all of, the preface to The Jewish State. So you'll see on what page that's numbered page 204 on the single page there. I'm going to read the beginning of the preface, even though we may not read through the whole thing. Here's what he says. The idea which I have developed in this pamphlet is an ancient one. It is the restoration of the Jewish state. The world resounds with clamor against the Jews, and this has revived the dormant idea. I claim no new discoveries. Let this be noted at once and throughout my discussion. I have discovered neither the Jewish situation as it has crystallized in history, nor the means to remedy it. The materials for the structure I here sketch exist in reality. They are quite tangible. This anyone can establish to his own satisfaction. Hence, if this attempt to resolve the Jewish question is to be described by a single word, let it be labeled not a fantasy, but at most a construction. It's a really interesting beginning. And again, we're reading in translation, so we have to be aware of that. But the sentence at the bottom of page 204 speaks very clearly of his motivation. The world resounds with clamor against the Jews, and this has revived the dormant idea. Right? So the idea of the return of Jews to the land of Israel, the ideas of a Jewish state, of Jewish independence, he's right. It didn't need a modern world. It didn't need an ism in the modern world to create that idea. It's been part of Jewish thinking since there's been Jewish thinking. But he's making a particular argument, and we'll see more detail in it in his speeches, that the reason that has come to the fore is because of the prevalence of the hatred expressed against Jews. Right? And we know that the situation of Jews in Central and Eastern Europe in the end of the 1800s, in the first decades of the 1900s, this was a time of more pogroms than can be counted. This is a time where lots of people's families like mine that have been in North America for a long time came in 1903, was when my family escaped from the Pale of Settlement in what is now Belarus and made its way to the United States, at least on my father's side, because of the situation that was facing Jews who were desperate for a better place, for a better way to live. So there's no, but I want to hear what Eleanor is raising her hand to say, but I think what we also need to, he says that what he is providing a response to, an attempt to resolve, is the Jewish question. So while we listen to the comment or question that Eleanor has, I want you to think about what are the different things that could be meant by the Jewish question. Because I want to come to that in a second. Yes, Eleanor.
Mm-hmm. Both sides came to Canada, and actually both to Montreal at that time. Mm-hmm. My mother's family, we have some proof, it's 1905. My father's family, around the same time.
Yeah, this was a time of enormous Jewish migration. And as I quoted on High Holidays, as the really one of the most amazing Jewish educators of this past century, and today he's still with us, thank God, Avram Infeld, said that really until 1948, after the word Jewish, the most common noun was refugee. You know, this was the life of the Jews from the earlier times we described, and certainly this was very actively real and present in the time in which Herzl lived. And again, like I said, there were lots of idealists before him, in the 40, 50 years before him, who expressed the idea. But notice the word construction, right? While he has the grand vision, what seems to have set Herzl aside was someone who was going to build the pieces to make it happen. And the last statement that we'll see tonight is one where he really says out loud of the importance of the ability to be committed to build realities, not just dream dreams or not just accept the world as it is. So I had said to you, what are the different things the Jewish question can mean? So what can that mean, quote unquote, the Jewish question that he was trying to remedy? What can it mean? Yes, Joe. Joe is suggesting that Herzl's apartment in Vienna has become a museum. I was there last January, and it really is worth the visit if you're in that part of the world. Absolutely. So, yes, please.
Talk about the Jewish question.
Yes.
With the moment one says that, we equal the Jewish problem.
Okay.
Moment one has a problem, mm-hmm. one has to find a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, group of people found what they call the final solution.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of problems with that myself, with the term question, but I don't see myself as a Jew as a problem,
mm-hmm.
or as questionable.
No. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. The response being that Jews are human beings, and raising the issue of as soon as we talk about the Jewish question, then that's the same, it's being suggested, as the Jewish problem. And we know where the idea of the Jewish problem led when it needs a solution to one of the places it led in the minds of the Nazis was to the final solution. Right? And so suggesting that's a negative way of looking at things now, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I am suggesting that that assumes that it's non-Jews who have the question, which is not the only, which is one way to look at this. Right? So the idea that the Jewish question is a question to be dealt with by, you know, the other people, And their question is, well, what do we do about the Jews? That's a very problematic question, I agree. And that, grounded in that idea of anti-Semitism, is not an idea, sadly, that has gone away. And I agree that that's problematic. But the Jewish question, as Herzl understands it, and you'll see as we continue in his words, is also questions that Jews have about what it means to be a Jew. About what is necessary, about what is the status of Jews in the world doing to Jews, and how can we remedy that? Right? Because we live, remember that Herzl lives in a time, I mean, one of the things that he says, that he was a great visionary, but he talks in one of his speeches about how the Ottoman Empire is completely indestructible. Right? But yet it would disappear about 15 years after he made that statement. So even visionaries, even the book of Isaiah makes some mistakes too. So it doesn't make him less important, but it means that he can't necessarily have foreseen everything that was going to happen. And so the expression of what became of anti-Semitism in the hands of the Nazis is something that he did not foresee. And could not certainly have foreseen. And I will say in that context a reminder, a very important thing when we're discussing Zionism, because of this, just a reminder, and we'll see it even more in this, that Israel exists despite the Holocaust, not because of it. Right? We'll often hear people describe it as if, in the way that you were understanding it, that Israel is the solution to the Jewish problem. You know, get these Jews away from here. And since the Holocaust didn't get rid of them, you send the Jews to this other place. That's not certainly something he could have imagined. And Zionism's success is based very much on the platform that was created through the hard work of Zionists and their organizations that were really founded by Herzl in a physical way, and that despite the murder of so many Jews, it was able to succeed because of a time in history, not because of the Shoah in some perverse way. And I think that I want to make sure we read enough of his words tonight while we have our time together. But I think the question that he's talking about, and we'll see it in more of his words, he recognizes that the rest of the world has a Jewish problem in its mind. But Herzl also has a Jewish question of his own about how is it that we can look after the safety and security of the Jewish people. And I think that he means both of those questions when he writes about this idea, both the question from without and the question from within. And if you don't agree with me, like I said, we don't have to agree on any of these things, but I think we'll see it a little more when we get to the statements from his speeches at the Zionist Congress as well. So I want to skip a little forward. Anne, you want to make a quick comment while I make sure we know where we're skipping forward to? We will read, Anne asks, is she right that at the Zionist Congress that he had lots of opposition, potentially from religious leaders? He didn't, as you'll see, he didn't have opposition from religious leaders at the Congress because they weren't there, because they opted to be outside. But he, one of the things he deals with, and none of us today can relate to that, is that the biggest threat to the Zionist movement is internal discord. Is Jews fighting with other Jews. And he says very clearly he's not against disagreement, but he will not stand personal attacks. It's interesting, Martin Buber, who we'll hear about more in one of the other nights, who was a very, not just a philosopher, but a very influential early Zionist, exchanged a lot of letters with Theodore Herzl. Remember things called letters? Everybody here remember those, right? They wrote back and forth, but we actually have the complete letters of Martin Buber, in which are the letters that describe the falling out between Martin Buber and Theodore Herzl. And the falling out was a very human falling out, again, about the feeling each of them had about the other, that they were letting their personal allegiances and feelings get in the way of the larger work of Zionism. Right? So, like I mentioned earlier, that it's kind of important for us to respect each other's opinions, even if we don't agree with one another. That's an extraordinarily difficult thing to achieve, and that was more the issue in Zionism. And you'll see why, than the religious leaders. But it's true that the religious leaders the religious camp stood outside very much. Even the religious Zionists were not largely in favor of Herzl's early work. That's true. See, more quick comment and then more of this. Pardon? Was assimilation a concern? You know what? Let's hold that off because it depends what assimilation means. There's a particular statement we're going to read from Herzl in a little bit that I want to share that really raises this whole issue of assimilation. Now, we all know, we're well trained in the world today, assimilation, we all go boo, right? Assimilation is always assumed to be a bad thing. And I'm not disagreeing with that, but it's not so clear in Herzl's writing. So I want to get back to that when we have the chance. One more comment, and then I'm going to force us back on here. Yes?
As I understand it, might be wrong. Mm-hmm. Zionism wasn't just safety to get away from persecution.
Mm-hmm.
But that the Jews could become normal people.
Mm-hmm.
Do their own work, clear their own garbage.
Yeah, so the statement that's being said, just so everybody can hear, because it's an important statement, is that it's not just for protection, Zionism, but also that Jews should become a normal people. And we'll see that. We should have our own work. We should have our own garbage. It's very important that the Jewish police should arrest the Jewish criminals and the Jewish drug dealers. And thankfully, we have that reality now. Oh, we're not so thankful necessarily. No, it raises the whole issue of what's good and not good. It fits in with assimilation about being normal. But there's no question that that's part of what Herzl is going to say to us. I'll get to you later, I promise. But look at the bottom paragraph on 205, because I think this is very interesting about what it is that makes Herzl different. 205. Bottom paragraph starts with, "Now everyone." Everybody see where I am?
Yep.
"Now everyone knows how steam is generated by boiling water in a kettle. But such steam only rattles the lid. The current Zionist projects and other associations to check anti-Semitism are tea kettle phenomena of this kind. But I say that this force, if properly harnessed, is powerful enough to propel a large engine and to move passengers and goods, let the engine have whatever form it may." Now, this is a really interesting distinction, and one, even if we don't discuss it, I want to challenge you to think about today. Because we have, as they did then, very well-developed Jewish communities, which lots of different ideas, lots of different organizations, lots of different thinking. And what he says, and I believe history shows him successful, that what he says his goal is there's a whole lot of steam. You know, there's a lot of people who are painfully aware in a most literal way about the situation in which Jews did and do live, and about the realities of anti-Semitism and Jewish exposure to abuse, even in places where we were tolerated. There's a lot of steam. So the question is, if you just put a loose lid on a pot, then it rattles. And that's all it does. You take the same amount of steam and you clamp that top on tight, you can actually harness that power and make something happen. And so, in fact, what really, as beautiful as Herzl's words are, what made him so important was that he was the center point, by far not the only one, of harnessing the steam in Jewish life, of making out of an idea the Jewish National Fund, you know, of creating specific entities, of gathering resources and organizing people so that energy wouldn't just make noise, but would make a difference, right? And the reason I say that's important is today, you will find, I don't know, in the broader Jewish community, here in this synagogue, different ideas of, well, there's Jewish energy, what's the practical thing to do about it? How do we harness Jewish ideas, Jewish energy, Jewish creativity, or Jewish discontent to make a difference in the Jewish world? And while everybody disagrees, and Herzl, history shows, was right in his ability to do so around the idea of Zionism, was more successful than others before him. Nevertheless, I think it's a good thing to think about. Is when we're part of, when we're choosing what to do with our own time and energy. We can't, none of us are prophets, even Herzl was not. But to try to dedicate our time to things that really move the people forward and try to notice, you know, the rattling of teapot lids for what they are. And I think it's quite an interesting. I want to turn to one more thing here and then I want to move us forward. On page 206, we've already turned over. Right? He deals with, at length, that I don't want to read, you can read this yourself, the idea that he's being accused of being utopian, that it's an unrealistic idea. And since we're the only people ever to successfully do this, I can see why people accused him of that. And yet it wasn't. But I want to share the last full paragraph on the page that starts with, I therefore state. Everybody see where I am? I therefore state clearly and emphatically that I believe in the achievement of the idea, though I do not profess to have discovered the shape it may ultimately take. The world needs the Jewish state, therefore it will arise. It's a powerful statement, but it's an interesting one to consider. Right? Do we agree? We don't have to argue it out now, but it's a good thing. Do we agree that the reason eventually why the Zionist project was successful, even with all of the organization and hard work and practicality, was because the world needed it? That there was a need in a broader sense? I think he makes a reasonable case. We don't have to agree on it. But it is interesting that, and again, it's something that I stand behind in a political way, but now when we talk about a long-term resolution of issues of the peoples living in the historical state of Israel, right, and now as opposed to in Herzl's day, we talk about two states for two peoples, right? I'm not saying anybody needs to agree or disagree with this idea. I'm describing the reality in which we live, right? The Palestinian people and the Jewish people. And I just wonder, because this idea and the challenge of this two-state idea is an interesting one. I couldn't help think of it as I was reading Herzl's words. Because I would agree that in the past and in the present, that the world needs the Jewish state. The question it raises for this resolution is whether the world needs a Palestinian state. And again, I'm not saying this to be right or wrong. I'm talking as a matter of politics, which is what he's discussing here. I just think it's an interesting question to consider and raise, because he's making a point that things that have a sort of a need or case tend to be possible to bring about. And things that don't. And I think this idea resolves nothing, and I'm not suggesting it makes somebody right or somebody wrong in their opinion, but I couldn't help but resonating about the challenge of that idea in the world today, An idea, if you ask me, that I think that Israel needs, but that doesn't mean the world needs it, is challenging in our times today. We're going to move on in a second. Jeff, do you want to make one quick comment first?
So as the founding theoretician of the state of Israel, he's talking a lot about the founding of a Jewish state.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the great that he has about the plurality of it is he comes from a land of monarchy, not of democracy. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned earlier about the idea of right that was emerging in the 19th century. So did he have any notion about this being a pure Jewish state, those of Jewish descendancy and the like, or would there be any kind of pluralism of other kinds of peoples and a democracy in this state that's somehow controlled by the Jews?
Jeff is asking about the nature of the state that Herzl was interested in founding. And I think that the most general answer is that we would know more about what Herzl thought about those ideas had he lived longer. That because of because he died so young, you can see he had here, which I think is really, I don't know that he was so humble, I don't know that I am, but I think it's very humble of him. To indicate he really doesn't know what he's building. He knows that if there's ever going to be an ending to the building of a Jewish state, there has to be a starting. And so everything that I read preparing of his own words preparing for this session was all about that approach, was about the idea of we need to build the infrastructure to protect the Jews. An infrastructure, a Zionist infrastructure. He established the World Zionist Congress, which is a democratic institution. The basic forms of the early Zionist entities that he created were democratic in a broader sense. At the same time, he really didn't deal with those issues. I think he didn't live long enough. I'm interested to know if they were able to bring him back and give him a peek later on, or even of the modern state of Israel, what he would say about those issues. But it's not something we can really know. But let's switch to the other sheet, his speeches, because we're not going to, our class doesn't go till 10 o'clock tonight. And I want to show you some of the words that you've asked about. Herzl's speeches at the Zionist Congress, right? And any typos, I'm going to blame on the translator because it's translated from the German, but I did the typing, so I apologize. But it's mostly readable, even if reproached is spelled wrong. But here's something really fascinating that I thought was that he said. Now, again, these are not intended. These are available online, all of his speeches. Any of you could access them in whole. I didn't want to do that. I want to choose lines that I thought might be of interest to us today. Because, again, these were formative times. So he didn't lay out a whole plan. Or here's what everything needs to be. But I did find it fascinating of him saying, why is it that now is the time that Jews from all over the world can come together to Basel and build the infrastructure of a Jewish homeland, of a Jewish state? And he says, first quotation that you have there, "It is only in our days that the marvels of communication have served to bring about mutual understanding and union between isolated groups." He's talking about of Jews, right? But it's funny, he must be referring to the invention of the internet, right? No, it's amazing how each communication revolution, not only the one we're living through, has changed the world, right? In fact, Margaret Macmillan, a wonderful Canadian historian, her books are important about this time of history as well. And her book, The War to End Peace, about World War I, talks about at length about the power of this brand new thing that she thinks is one of the main reasons there was a First World War, or the Great War at that time, called public opinion. It was new because of the evolution of modern media and communication. It was something that hadn't existed before and existed at that time. And so as communication evolved and the wireless, et cetera, and all these connections among people, Herzl says that's what really enabled this moment in time, the beginning of Zionism, to happen. I think that's interesting because I think it should raise the question of what will the communication revolution we're living in mean to the future of Zionism. And not just because Israel is a startup nation. I'm not just talking about making money and starting businesses. But I really believe that since Jews living in different places have the ability to be connected to each other in a new way if they wish to, and if they have the skills, that I found it fascinating that in his day it was about communication, because I think today it's still something extremely important to reflect on. Of how does our changing reality. I mean, even when I visited Israel for that one time 30 years ago, been there so many times since, in 1987, right? You had to stand next to the phone for it to ring, and we had those blue air letters. Remember those? Right? To save money, you write on them, fold them over, and then getting them open, you tear up half the letter and can't read what the person wrote you anyway, right? And that's only 30 years ago. Right? And now we take youth from this synagogue to Israel and they walk along the street tripping on the sidewalk because they're texting their mother or their friends. Right? So there's an enormous difference. And I think it will matter. And the more we can think about how it matters, I think Herzl was hinting at us that it mattered in his day. It probably matters in ours too. Quick comment, Michael? Yeah.
Just quickly on the subject of communication. About 15, 16 years ago, I worked at a company of about 50 people with a marketing company, and I was the only Jew there. This company was at Avenue of Glory, and I assure you that these people had pretty much no Jewish friends and absolutely no concept as to any aspect of Jewish identity, almost as if I had a tail. And this was not 100 years ago. This was, the internet did exist then. It was slow, but it existed then. And it occurs to me that if in a major metropolitan location with a very large Jewish community, I could go into a place where nobody had the first idea what a Jew was, that if you go back 100 years, imagine, especially by and large people raised by religions that were
less than friendly,
hostile to Jews. It makes complete sense that when
you think
about the context, any improvement in communication was beyond revolutionary.
Right, but and the challenge, we're going to see it in a moment in his other statements too, is that the evolution of communication is at once a blessing and a curse. Right? So we can know so many things because of the changes in digital and internet communication and the proliferation of hate, anti-Zionism, and anti-Semitism on the internet is astonishing. Right? So all of these things are tools. They're not good. They're not bad. They're tools. What's good or bad is how we use them, how we take responsibility for them, how we manage them. Look at the second statement that I've chosen for you here from his first Zionist Congress. He says, from time immemorial, the world has been misinformed about us. The sentiment of solidarity with which we have been reproached so frequently and so acrimoniously was in the process of disintegration at the period when we were attacked by anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism served to strengthen it anew. We returned home, as it were. For Zionism is a homecoming to the Jewish fold, even before it comes, a homecoming to the Jewish land. So that's really quite an amazing statement. And again, when he's talking about the reality in his world, the way he sees it, we can argue if he's right or not, but his ideas matter. The way he sees it is that, basically, Jews, left to their own devices, cannot maintain a sense of unity, even though we're accused in his days and still today in the protocols of the Elders of Zion and other anti-Semitic forgeries of being this worldwide cabal that's working together for nefarious ends all over the world. He's like, you know, I can see him in today sitting in a meeting going, working together, have you met Jews? Is that really what you think is happening? But he's suggesting a reality that in some ways that Jewish, the sense of Jewish unity grows weaker and dissipates. And historically, it's anti-Semitism that reinforced it in many ways. And I think that's an experience many can relate to. But he sees Zionism as a positive way to unite Jews. Because he's saying, and I think that last statement is incredible, it's a homecoming to the Jewish fold. It's about the idea of being part of a Jewish nation, whether you're there or not. Whether you're like the other Jews, or agree with the other Jews, or see the world as the other Jews, it's the idea of being part of a Jewish fold, a Jewish family, a Jewish nation. Right? I mean, you're all members of your family because all of you in your family all agree with each other, right?
Yeah.
Least of all. It's not about being one Jewish organism, but it's about an interconnectivity. And he sees the main strength behind Jewish connectivity being negative, being the outside antagonism, and wants to create a positive returning to ourselves as Zionism, not merely... I want to share one more thing from this. I see a couple of hands, and then I'm happy to call on them. But this last statement, two statements, the third to last, it says, starts one of the first. Everybody see where I am? One of the first results of our movement, even now to be perceived in its larger outlines, will be the transformation of the Jewish question into the question of Zion. And I think that's fascinating because he completely presages what goes on in the world now. That all of he was successful, not that it resolved a Jewish challenge, but it has refocused the world. And that while there still is generalized anti-Semitism and philo-Semitism, for that matter, those who love the Jews, that exists too, in the world, that there has been a transition as a result of Zionism from a focus on the Jewish people to a focus on the Jewish state. And I think we see that in the larger world in communication as well. And the last statement that I brought you from that particular one, and it goes back to the Jewish version of the Jewish question. He says, Zionism, or self-help for the Jews, points to a way out of these numerous and extraordinary difficulties. Zionism is simply a peacemaker, and it suffers the usual fate of peacemakers in being forced to fight more than anyone else. Right? So, again, he seems to have really been a prophet in a number of different ways, right? Talking about the challenge of what we believe ourselves to be and the difference between the inside version of the Jewish question, the Jewish idea, the Jewish situation, Zionism, and that outside idea. And the challenge that while you can't make peace with arms, you also can't make peace by laying down your arms in the real world. That he was aware of that, that that is in fact the nature of humankind. And long before there was a state, he saw the reality of that. There are a couple of people. Carla, is your comment still relevant, or do you want to make it? Because I know I kind of passed you by. Yeah, Carla's sharing absolutely another story about people who just don't know Jews. How many people here, and we'll move on, but how many people here have met someone who you were the first Jewish person they had ever met? Right, so look at that. It's a big number. Even here, that doesn't happen in Israel too much. Other places, pretty much. For the government? You work for the government?
Yeah. And I've got to tell you, in my office, of course, there's diversity in the government.
Yeah.
They plant something on your people. Okay?
Yeah.
And I said, I'm sorry, I can't be there. And they couldn't figure out why. And I said,
yeah.
It's the Jewish holiday. Yeah. Everybody knows everything about all the other religions.
Yes, another example of even working for the government, something was planned on Yom Kippur, and sometimes it really is just ignorance. But again, do the math, right? Yeah, right. A reminder that Jews are less than 0.25% of the world's population, and half of us live in five places, right? 75% of Jews live in major urban areas. So that means a lot of the world are people who have no experience nor contact with anybody or anything Jewish in a personal way. Seymour. Yes. Okay.
We want to find a state, we want to make it a Jewish state, we want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
The world needs a country that's doing the right thing. Now, the United States thinks it has a Supreme Court. Structure that leads to the best solutions.
Yeah.
And the Jewish people think that they have.
Now, Seymour's talking about the ethics of the matter and about a state that's doing the right thing. I don't think that that's what Herzl means here. He's not talking about the Jewish state being more ethical, but rather, that's the biblical idea of the light to the nations. Right, that we Jews have a responsibility to be an ethical and otherwise light to the nations. That's not his idea. He's more saying that the world and you'll see as we get further into some of these comments, that also that allowing the Jewish people to continue to languish in the experiences they have, he also makes a case, interesting case, is bad for the world, not just bad for the Jews. That the Jews need a place where they can look after their own needs, and that it's beneficial to the world as well. He's making that argument more than arguing. He's not arguing that it's somehow going to be a better state. He doesn't speak to that. I'm sure he had hopes, but he's not speaking to that here, I don't think. Okay. Yes, quickly.
I go up every summer to the Halliburton School of the Arts and I do memoir writing, and every year we come back and they say, we're so glad you're back because we're going to keep learning more about Judaism.
Yeah. No, it's about a comment that people often are fascinated with the Jewish people or with Jewishness because it is something. We don't realize living in a Jewish community, being around lots of other Jews, we often can easily forget how uncommon and unique it is. David, something quick?
Yes, 2 points.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In regard to Zionism, within the Zionist movement, I think was brought out in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, where there were the two factions who were fighting the Nazis, and they wouldn't cooperate with each other.
Right. So David's bringing the example that even in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, there were different factions who wouldn't cooperate with each other. So it is a problem that's endemic to humanity and to the Jewish people. One last thing. Does anti-Semitism make us stronger Jews is an age-old question. And Herzl's answer is no. His answer is no. His answer is, it's part of the reason why Jews are still here. Right? Because it forces us together. But as you will see, I'm actually going to now go through a bunch of things to make sure we get through them. It's my own fault, not anybody here. That his answer is that anti-Semitism is an evil, and that while it does have some, it is a partial responsibility for the existence of the Jews, it also explains the bad condition of the Jews as they existed in his day in Herzl's mind. So let me share a bunch of these. Second Zionist Congress The second statement that I chose from what he said starts with every genuine nationality. Everybody see it? Every genuine nationality which does not hide behind a strange mask has a fundamental right to respect and toleration on the part of other nations, provided it does not menace their existence. I just think that's a real mouthful. And again, something that it's astonishing how differently people can interpret those words. About the idea of a genuine nationality, it's interesting that he said that, because there's a lot of disagreement even today, people calling other peoples. I'll choose a non-Jewish example, right? The Rohingya, the people right now who are refugees in the Far East from Myanmar into Bangladesh. There's a whole argument of are they a real nationality or not, right? The people who persecute them say they're not. They say they are, right? Look at what's going on with the Kurds. He's talking about issues that are not only Jewish issues, but continue also to be Jewish or Zionist issues. The idea of a genuine nationality, the idea that given that we are, which I certainly believe in that, that there is a fundamental right to respect and toleration, provided it doesn't menace the right? You can't expect somebody who's threatened, right? And that's still relevant to people who don't understand why Israel won't, you know, kind of chill out about Hamas, as an example. No, you find a lot of these opinions in the world, not in this room necessarily, as an example. But when, and it's not just, that's just a Jewish example, but when someone is overtly dedicated to your destruction, you can't, unless they somehow demonstrate they no longer are, extend to them the kind of respect and toleration that he's talking about, even if you want to. The next statement, interestingly enough, is about his disappointment in the Orthodox Zionists of his day, on the bottom of the page. However, an idea like ours cannot be left to the mercy of those who have heretofore been presidents of Jewish communities or to the opportunistic considerations of their spiritual advisors. Jay, I wonder how he feels. Almost everywhere, the masses are with us. It is they who constitute as well as support the communities. Consequently, their wishes must be carried out. Hitherto, we have refrained from emphasizing this inconsistency out of brotherly consideration. But finally, it has become necessary to make a change. Right? So again, Jews speaking out in criticism of other Jews or other Jewish ideas is something he's against, except when he feels he has to. And I'm not saying that to be critical of him. This is the real challenge, right? Of how do you, one of the things I spoke about on High Holidays this year was about the danger of being tolerant of intolerance. We're so against being intolerant that we're sometimes not even intolerant of intolerance itself, whether directed from within the Jewish world or outside. And so these are challenging ideas to live. Now, we talked earlier about assimilation, right? So look at the last statement of the second Zionist Congress. That's the fourth statement on the back of this front page, right? Let's see if everybody can figure that out, right? Because I wasn't smart enough to number them. But you can see on the back of that first page, it starts with, of course, the top of the page does. And then about after four statements, it says Third Zionist Congress. Everybody see where I am? We getting there? Right? And he says, perhaps the efficiency of the Germanic peoples, the versatility of the Latin peoples, the great patience of the Slavs have not passed over us without leaving an impression. It's part of a larger context, but what he's actually talking about is a positive aspect of assimilation. Not assimilation as we think of it, meaning the diminution of Jewish identity. But as modern people, including modern Jews, believe in progress. We believe in evolving. We believe that everything changes. Nothing stays the same. So that means, which I believe to be a historical truth, but some of my more traditionalist colleagues would disagree with me. The Jews have never stayed the same. And that we've always been influenced by the outside cultures into which we've come into contact. Sometimes influenced us away from them and sometimes toward them, don't get me wrong, but always influenced. And assimilation, if we let go of the overlay of judgment, means taking things in from outside, right? It means taking on characteristics of those around us. So Herzl, when you talk about it being a better state, he was not religious. He's in favor of the normalization of the Jewish people, us having a Jewish homeland to call our own. But part of that is he's not opposed to assimilation in some forms, meaning to seeing Jews become modern people, because he lived in a time when many of the Jews were not modern. Right? And in fact, in Israel today, the largest demographic, the largest growing demographic, is a non-modern demographic, which is the ultra-Orthodox community. Right? The ultra-Orthodox community, that's true, they're against assimilation. They're against assimilation in every sense. Right? Against any sense of modernization and progress and growth and these crazy modern ideas like a state of Israel. So it continues to be a complex notion, and that while assimilation is itself, when we talk about the losing of Jewish identity, that's a problem, but Jewish identity itself never stays entirely the same. And so there's also the issue of what do we see as a positive evolution of Jewish identity. Because as he says in so many words, if I find it, it's not about going back, it's about going forward. Now, from the Third Zionist Congress on August the 15th, 1899, we're going to go for about 7 more minutes organized-wise, just so people know, as far as, because I know we can't go forever on a Tuesday night. If people have individual questions, I'm happy to stay and answer them. When I said earlier about how people are affected by anti-Semitism, let's look at the two last excerpts that I've chosen for you from the Third Zionist Congress, below halfway on the page, right? The last two. The second to last starts with Jewry is. Everybody with me? Jewry is a tremendous tenement of misery with branches all over the world. This, too, you will hear from our forum, the Congress, as it is the sad truth. And these conditions cry for a remedy. Deep misery is the cause of disease and moral neglect, and heavy hearts are fertile soil for the most extreme revolutionary thoughts. Right? Jews aren't only overrepresented in winners of Nobel Prizes in our world today. Right? They were in the world overrepresented in revolutionary movements like the communists, right? And anarchists as well. Lots of the young anarchists, something a very still present part of the world then, were made up of disillusioned young Jewish people. Trotsky, of course, is in many ways the ultimate example, but others as well. He was a communist, of course, not an anarchist, but he's saying here, anti-Semitism causes either decay, disease, and moral neglect, or a turning to extreme means out of desperation. So I think it's clear that he wouldn't. I think this statement, and it's characteristic of many other statements he makes, is that while historically anti-Semitism may have caused, been a partial reason for the continuance of Jewish existence, it also does and did break down what and who we are, in his opinion. And again, he's trying to, as we saw earlier in his statement, to make a positive Jewish identity as opposed to a negative Jewish identity. Yes, it's about mutual protection because we don't get that from anybody else, but it doesn't stop there. It's about not being forced into extreme and revolutionary thinking because we have a safety and a home base to think in a more constructive, healthy manner. And look at the last the last thing he describes. Again, he's even clearer here in this last statement. Under present conditions, the Jews have three roads before them. One is apathetic submission to insult and poverty. Another is revolt, outspoken hostility to an unjust social system. Ours is the third road. Right? So he really is saying in a very clear way, and again, these were enormously troubling Jewish times, times in which he wasn't wrong. And I'm a believer, this is not a historical fact, so I can't tell you it's true. I'm a believer that we would have way too much in common with Herzl's times if there were no Israel today. That many people seem to have convinced themselves, and it's a belief, so I can't prove to them they're wrong. Many people seem to believe that the positive evolution in Jewish life is not directly related to Israel, nor the general safety of Jews in many parts of the world. I'm personally quite thoroughly unconvinced that, in fact, a lot of the evolution of Jews and our security in places in the world and our feeling of security and our ability to positively define ourselves, I think, is specifically because we live in a time where there is a Jewish state. And while there are other reasons, I think it's prominent among them. Jeff, you want to make a quick comment, and then I want to conclude with two things. Well, Herzl believed, especially after Dreyfus, that they appeared to be integrated, that they weren't. And there were representatives of all of these different Jewish communities at the Congress. So there were report after report of the Jews from Romania, of the Jews from the Pale, of the Jews from all of these different locations, with people coming and saying, here's what our people are experiencing right now. And in fact, the murder of Jews in Romania is discussed painfully in these things because he's saying it's happening right now and we're doing nothing except talking about it.
Where there were approximately, I believe, 850,000 Jews in that one country. Just think about that in terms of the Jewish population.
Yeah, no, and so just at the a regular part of the Congress were reports from the representatives from all of these diasporic communities saying, here's what we're going through. So that was definitely part of it. But you're right, and it's significant that he was leading from a place where many believed us to be accepted, and where he seems to have believed that in general until his experience with the Dreyfus affair. The Fourth Zionist Congress in London. Okay, it's just a few things, so let me conclude by reading those. Under that it says, and again, here's where he's at, Zionism demands a publicly recognized and legally secured home in Palestine for the Jewish people. You know, every one of those words is important, right? I'm sure you're a massive fan of the United Nations like I am. I say that tongue firmly in cheek. But the truth is, a big part of publicly recognized and legally secured is connected to the history of the UN and to the fact that there is recognition, legally and otherwise, of Israel in that way. Next statement, which I think is so true today, but I am convinced that those Jews who stand aside today with a malicious smile and with their hands in their trousers pockets will also want to dwell in our beautiful house. Right? Just because people don't support Zionism, don't support Israel, not with their money, not with their ideas, even people who live in Israel, the roughly 800,000 Jews who live in Israel who are anti-Zionists, meaning the Haredi community, that 90-some percent of whom are anti-Zionist. Nevertheless, they have a really nice house to live in. No, and I think he's right not just about them. It's about the broader community that people, will accept. you know, Israel's protection and the positive things they find about Israel, even as they're critical. And that's just a part of human nature, I think. But turning over to these last two statements, this last one, let's do the second to last one. The last one's what I want to end in. Let it be one of the duties of this Congress to establish financial agencies by means of which our Zionists will in future attempt to guarantee reciprocal aid to one another in cases of necessity. So again, he's if he was just a dreamer, we would not know his name. Right? It was very much about setting up the financial and organizational realities necessary so that even if there weren't a Jewish state, that Jews could aid each other and protect each other when they were under threat. And of course, that was an enormous reality in his day. And this last statement, I think it's got to be like, I got to have a shirt made and just wear it all the time. We shall have shown that Jewry is still capable of an idealism which defies danger, endures privation, and possesses the infinite patience through which great ends are achieved. Right? This is what it takes to have something that we really believe in, not just to have a Jewish state, but to see it grow and thrive. It takes all of these things, right? It takes the reality of dealing with the dangers in our world in whatever way. We have to be willing to do that for what we believe in. We have to be willing to have it have a negative impact on us. That's what privation says, if we believe in it. But this last one, I think, is the greatest modern and Western weakness that I see in the world today, is to that we have to possess the infinite patience through which great ends are achieved. Things that really matter don't happen in a day or a year or a generation. They require our commitment to the future, not just to what they are or can be today. And I can't think of, his words are beautiful. Reading Herzl is a wonderful experience to begin with. But he's this dreamer who also knew about organization and practicality, and who said, we're here because Jews have always taken the long view. And if we stop taking the long view in whatever we do, we will endanger our ability to do things of true substance and significance. And I find his wording about it and his way of approaching of it truly inspiring. I hope you do as well. I really appreciate everybody joining us tonight. We'll be talking about more than one thinker in each of the next two sessions that we're talking about and looking at a variety of Jewish and Zionist worldviews. I thank you for coming, and I look forward to seeing you next week.